Welcome to Your Career Podcast, the podcast that helps to ensure your career success. To start getting on track with your career, download my free career goals calendar from thecareersacademy.online. My goals calendar includes a SMART goals template and a weekly tasks sheet that will ensure step by step you get closer to reaching your career goals. So download my goals calendar today at thecareersacademy.online. Now on with the show. Welcome back to Your Career Podcast. If you ever feel stuck in your career, or you need a little clarity in order to manage your career moving forward, or you're looking for a new job, visit janejacksoncoach.com. I've plenty of free downloads for you and a lot of career management support that will help to set you well on your way.
Welcome to Jane Jackson Careers, a podcast that takes your career to the next level. Here's your host, Jane Jackson, author of Amazon Careers bestseller, Navigating Career Crossroads.
Let's welcome Lee Lam to the show. Lee Lam is based in London, is a LinkedIn local host, and is an instigator of change. So whether it's a business, a team, or an individual, Lee thinks outside of the box and challenges the belief that we have to think in the same familiar and failing ways. Having worked in financial technology industry for the last 20 years, most recently in senior COO chief of staff roles, Lee is the right blend of risk-taking, change-making creativity with the security, safety, and logic of a COO who can implement change without any dramas. For individuals, Lee challenges them to think big about their career and their ambition with a plan of action that makes success a when, not an if. So let's welcome Lee to the show.
Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
Very well. And it's a very hot day in London, I believe. I'm over in Sydney. I've got my big scarf on because I'm cold. So being so many miles away, how is London doing?
London struggles a little bit in the heat. We're not used to it. So everybody enjoys it. And there's this manic rush in the first few days to have barbecues and go swimming and go for picnics. And then we all get a little bit tired. And it's at that stage. Yeah, we kind of, a bit of nice cool weather would be really welcomed. Yeah, but we're too frightened to say it just in case it goes and doesn't come back.
You don't want to have grey skies forever. But I guess, I mean, London's not really cut out for such very hot weather. But you had the most beautiful, beautiful summer. So actually, you're very lucky. And I'm in the middle of winter. But this is Your Career Podcast. And it's all about career transition and how you made the change from corporate to entrepreneurship. So how about, just to kick us off, Lee, let's find out, what were your early career aspirations when you were a little girl?
So when I was a very little girl, at the point where I began reading, I loved creating stories, and my mum would find books and books of exercise books of poems and stories, and I always aspired to be a writer. Then when I reached my teens, I was looking for career choices and actually saw a program on TV for barristers and lawyers. And I thought, there's a job where people get to argue for a living. And I thought I'd found my heaven. Mm-hmm. So at the age of 13, I said to my mum, I'm going to become a barrister. And my school, I was one of the only people at my school to want to go to university. And they had nothing about barristers in the careers library at all. They had to bring it all in. But I was absolutely adamant that was my choice. I couldn't believe that people could get paid for being able to argue their side of the case and, you know, put forward really logical arguments. I loved that idea. Mm. But the writing went to one side for a long time.
And then, so you studied law?
Yes, so mm-hmm. at university, I went to Keele University, mm-hmm. and at the time they did dual honours. So it was two full degrees at the same time. So I did law and also American studies, which I used almost as relief because law is a very full-on subject. And although I absolutely adored it, there was a lot to it. It was a lot of hard work.
Mm. And what happened once you graduated? Did you want to be called to the bar or exactly how did things transpire?
I think what I realised at university was that there was more to getting into that career than simply being good at arguing. There was a lot of opportunities. And when you see hundreds of students all going for 10 jobs in a law firm, you suddenly realise that it's really stacked against you. And so at that time, I thought rather than go straight into the remainder of the legal training, I would take a gap year to just get some corporate experience, commercial experience, because I wanted to do commercial law. So I thought, oh, I'll go into a company, work with them for about a year. And then when I apply to do the legal training, the second part, I've got something that's different to the people coming directly out of university. So that's what I did.
Mm. And that's valuable advice, really, for any student who's thinking about going into law and how they can actually let their careers progress once they graduate as well. But you've had quite an interesting career journey because you've taken a few twists and turns along the way.
Absolutely.
Because I've written here, I got trading floor analyst at RBS, head of service delivery at Barclays, and all of these other roles. So let's hear the story, because I'm always fascinated about how people make a career transition, and you've made some pretty big ones. So how did your early 20s go through till today?
Yeah. So when I took the gap year, I was really fortunate that at the time there was a year-long contract offered for a motor company to work on a tech program that was rolling out their new online ordering. And this was in the days where online anything wasn't really a thing. So it was a big project. It was really interesting to come in at a point where it was midway, they were just starting that final push. And what I realized was I really enjoyed the dynamics. So although I enjoyed the law for that logical, rational element, it's quite slow. Everything kind of moves quite gradually. And what I realized is in technology, it's almost the complete opposite. You get the logic and the rational thinking that comes with programming and project management, but you also get this buzz because everybody's aiming towards something that wasn't there before and you're creating something new. And I really enjoyed the collaboration in the team as well as my own personal objectives and fulfilling them. So at the end of the year, instead of going back into law, I wanted to explore technology. I thought it probably made a bit more sense because I liked the dynamic nature of it that wasn't available in law at the time. So I thought, right, I'll apply for a graduate scheme. And honestly, I never expected to get the actual job. I thought, because I'd seen all of my friends from university fill out countless applications for graduate schemes and not get anywhere, you know, and this is one of the frustrations that I've seen from the very beginning of my career, that there just appears to be such restriction and limitation on the opportunities. So I applied thinking, okay, I'll see what this looks like. I'll go through the process. And each stage I go through is learning for when I find a role that I really want. And I kept getting through all the different interviews and the tests. And eventually I got to the weekend where we were told that 48 hours we were being monitored. So there were cameras everywhere. And it was a real experience. But still, I think the reason I actually ended up getting the role was because I genuinely didn't think I was going to. So I was really relaxed. I had a bit of a to-do at the weekend with one of the assessors because I thought they were being quite difficult. And everybody else is sitting there like, oh my goodness, you can't say that, they're assessing you. I was like, yeah, it's fine, I can say it. And I got the role and actually ended up in his team. So I kind of paid the price for having that. But it was brilliant experience. Mm. And from that, I think I've always realized that you have to be able to own who you are. That's what they're looking for. It's not about checking off their to-dos and what they need. It's presenting yourself and what value you can offer. Mm-hmm. So
you know what's interesting is mm-hmm. I was doing a career transition workshop today and talking about mm-hmm. what it is that tips the balance in an interview situation. And it sounds like for you, you were yourself.
Yeah.
Yourself. Oh,
yeah.
You expressed an opinion. You had some get up and go about you, and you weren't just being meek and mild, and they obviously wanted someone who had personality and a bit of gumption as well.
Yeah.
So that obviously came through.
Yeah, and I think it was the fact that I hadn't pinned all my hopes on the situation. You know, in later years when I was conducting interviews, you almost try to give them a prep talk before you start interviewing, because, you know, they sit there and their hands are clammy and they don't know whether to reach for the glass of water or not, and they just look so scared. And you know that you're not going to see the real person, so you have to try and encourage people to feel comfortable. So I used to interview alongside someone else, and we would deliberately come in having a discussion about something off telly or something that was in the newspaper, and then go, what do you think? Because we're having this discussion, what do you think? And just try to make people relax, because as a hiring manager, you want to see the person who's going to rock up Monday morning. You don't want to see that polished, highly anxious person that usually comes into the interview room.
Mm-hmm, exactly, because people have an interview face, don't they? You know, they prep themselves and prep themselves, but because they get so worked up, you never see the real person unless they're treating the interview as if it's interview practice, or else they just think of the interview as a conversation. I always say, think of the interview as a conversation. They want to learn about you. You want to learn about them. And that's all it is, really. No need to be so nervous. But what about you then? So how did the career progress?
So when I moved, I got the graduate job in RBS and was originally put in the data center. So you've got to bear in mind, at this point, I was a law student with 1 year's project management exposure, being put into a highly technical environment. I was female, I was English up in a Scottish bank, and I was a graduate. So I had, you know, three strikes against me in terms of the other people, which immediately I realized I had to perform. You know, I had to work out what it was they wanted and how I could deliver that. And because that was my focus, I think I was able to learn quicker. I demonstrated that I had the abilities, but I wanted to make sure that I used them in the right ways. And so I started getting on the radar of a few people. There was one person in London who I talked to on a regular basis. And again, because I wasn't openly after a new job, I was having a chat with him, and he said, oh, would you ever come down to London? And I said, yeah, you know, if there's something that interests me, you know, that's been my mantra everywhere. If it's interesting, if it excites me, I'll look into it. So there's no real career choice or path there. It's just what keeps me excited and motivated. And he got me the role in the trade floor support team, where I actually met my husband. So it was a great move from that point of view. But more, it introduced me to yet another dynamic environment, because a trade floor, financial services, investment banking, very different creature to retail banking or a group headquarters. And I absolutely loved it. I loved the fact that you were, even though you were a support group being technology, they understood that you were a critical part of them doing their job well. So we were involved in a lot of business discussions. We were encouraged to learn about how trading worked as much as how the technology worked. So it broadened my experience, and I was able to carry that through right the way through Barclays and Fidelity and UBS. And I think it was the combination of having that commercial awareness plus the technology awareness that made it easier for me to transition between those roles.
Yeah, because it's so interesting, because as a trading floor analyst, RBS, and then you transitioned to Barclays, where you ended up as head of service delivery.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, a bit of a change, a slightly different culture as well. Yeah. But then you had a stint in between of being a coach at Penner LHH before then going to UBS as chief of staff. This is just so interesting, your career path. Just following it here. So chief of staff at UBS, and then back at Barclays again as chief of staff in application services. Yes?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that was when you made your transition into entrepreneurship.
Yes, it was.
So now that's interesting. So being in banking, being on the trading floor, being in investment banking as well, and then having a number of changes, being a coach for a while, I'm assuming that this was a conscious decision that you decided to move away. And then you must have missed it, because then you went back to banking again. What was going through your head?
So when I was the service delivery manager back at Barclays, there was a lot that I began to get frustrated with. You know, the way large corporations work, it's very much like a big engine, and it's very difficult to make your mark. It's really difficult to really feel that you are contributing in a way that's recognized. And my manager sent me on a course for how to go through promotion, how to challenge yourself and get there, which was delivered by a coach. And it was a day-long program. And as you're very aware, she did some coaching exercises with us about values, what's your core values, what's your beliefs. And at lunchtime, she said, how are you finding it? And I said, I realize I'm entirely in the wrong job. Because a lot of the things that were important to me, I wasn't able to fulfill in that role. I wanted to be able to encourage my team members to perform at their best. That was something that happened very naturally for me. But in the corporate environment, that was left to the appraisal system. And it was all about getting the most out of people. And it's a very aggressive environment. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to change anytime soon, because the dynamics that attracted me there also require that aggression in some way. So by the end of the day, she was slightly panicked, because that wasn't obviously the aim of the workshop. So she called me to one side again and said, well, what are you thinking now? And I said, I want your job. That's what I want. Because what I saw was this ability to take someone from 0 to 10. And it really drove me. So I went home that evening. I booked up for a course to learn how to be a coach, qualified in 2004. And I've effectively run my coaching practice since then, doing various types of things. What I realized a few years, though, was coming out of that environment was all very well, but it actually needed that energy back in. And so I was thinking, is there a way for me to bring in my coaching ethos back into a corporate commercial environment and make a difference? Can I sort of, you know, rebel from within? And so my choice to go back into UBS was very much geared on that principle, going back in with my new mindset, and could I make and inspire change in others? I was very lucky to have some very supportive managers through UBS and through Barclays who encouraged me to embrace that part of my my skill set and my knowledge base. But I still ran into that corporate machine where people are numbers, their resources, their headcount. And we stop thinking that we're actually making people available to live their lives and to support their lives. And that felt difficult to me. And that's where I realized that the amount of time that I could do what I wanted to do within corporates was limited. And so I started exploring the idea of the entrepreneurship and starting out on my own. Because it is that reality that sometimes those large companies want to hear from a trusted external resource what they need to do. And that advice isn't as readily available from inside. There's this this slight doubt in their mind that what you're saying is valid. Whereas when you're an external consultant who's done more work, more research in the marketplace, it becomes easier for them to accept what you're saying. So I thought, okay, I've tried rebelling inside. I've done as much as I can. I now need to be the rebel on the outside.
But I 100% agree with you there, because so often if they have an internal trainer, team members don't pay as much attention if they know that, oh, this is a salaried employee. Yeah. And whenever I coach, I mean, we do very similar work.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm brought into an organization to conduct any training, they love having an external facilitator. What's it like out in the real world? They might ask. Exactly. And also, it's a different personality. It's not someone who belongs in the machine as such.
Yes.
And it's a fresh perspective that really challenges them to think a little bit differently as well.
Yeah.
And so that must have been very exciting for you.
It was, definitely. And having the freedom to be able to say what I wanted without having to think of reporting lines and hierarchy, mm-hmm. and was I the person who was able to say that? I also did hit in a number of the companies that feeling that there was, and I see it with my clients as well, my female clients, what we all tend to do is wait for someone to spot our talent. You know, we think that if we work hard and we keep performing, that someone will pluck us up from the masses and go, yeah, you're the star. And
doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen as often as you'd like it to. Mm-hmm. But when that's against a more male opinion of, I want that job, I'm going to go get it, and I'm going to explain to them why I'm the best person, even if the female is better qualified, it's really difficult for the senior guys to see that and to give that balance of which is the best candidate, because they've got one person who's really going for it and the other one who's kind of expecting them to do some of the work for them. And I saw that in the companies. When I came out on my own, it's a different vibe. As a woman, I have to almost be the male and the female, you know, which excites me because I think it gives me a much better perspective. And it's a little bit different, you know, having a female consultant come in and talk to you can be a little bit easier to deal with. I was having this really interesting discussion with one of my male networking colleagues, and he's a consultant as well. And I said, oh, you know, sometimes I feel like because I'm a woman going in, maybe they think I'm a bit soft, that I'm going to be too emotional, and, you know, it works against me. And he said, yeah, but from the male perspective, I'm going in and maybe they see me as more of a threat. So instead of listening to what I'm saying, they're trying to make sure that they still feel on top because it's this male v male thing. Mm-hmm. And that was honestly a perspective I'd never thought of before. So it is just about making the most of the strengths of all of it and keeping the target on what are you delivering? What's your value? What's your contribution? And not worrying too much about trying to second guess what everyone else is doing out there.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, all coaches are highly tuned to listening and finding out exactly what issues there are, the unspoken issues as well, what the solutions might be. And rather than coming in and saying, right, this is what we've got to do, because we're not management consultants, we're coaches. So it's really bringing out the best in the individuals as well by letting them express themselves. And I think sometimes a softer approach, it's like a powerful but soft approach, works very well, because you've got to have people feel comfortable in your presence as well and know that there's no external agenda. It's just out there.
Exactly.
And I'm here for the benefit of the organization, but for the benefit of you too. And so building up that trust must feel very rewarding for you now.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. I think the real value of having that coaching mentality is you understand the need for rapport. So you immediately go into that and create a partnership with whoever you're talking about. This isn't I'm coming in and I'm going to tell you exactly what to do. that's not the coaching ethos at all. It's like, I trust that you have the answer. Mm. It's up to me to get it out of you. So I think a lot of people find that easier to deal with. But there is that strength, that approach that says, I'm going to challenge your thinking, because if you say something that logically doesn't make sense, I'm going to dig into that and clarify that with you. Whereas maybe a traditional consultant who's used to what are your deliverables, what are your objectives, doesn't necessarily go in with that same mindset. Hence the reason you start the assignment and all of a sudden there's already this disconnect between what's expected and what's being delivered. Mm. I think in the coaching space, we just have that. We're more prone to clarify and confirm. And because of that, when we come in to do the assignment, we're in a much better place to hit the ground running.
Mm. And I think also, because it's such an interesting topic, also it's a matter of people treating people as individuals rather than someone who's going to hit KPIs all the time. Because sometimes you wonder why people are underperforming, and it can be for so many different reasons. And unless you listen, you don't know what it is that's holding them back, what the fear might be, the whatever disgruntles them. So often it's like you must meet these KPIs and just do it. But you're not talking to individuals then, because everyone's got things that might be holding them back, things that will really motivate them as well. Now, you do some interesting work, okay, because you like to challenge companies to think about how they define jobs, yes?
Yes.
And how they actually recruit the right people as well.
Yeah.
So what are you doing in that space?
Well, my time in the corporate environment made me really question whether the way that we recruit people, whether it works anymore. I think we've had years of that machinery, that idea that we're all cogs in the machine. And so we've also created this very clunky way of getting people in. You know, if somebody leaves, you tend to think that you need to have somebody who is as close a fit as possible to who's left. So, you know, cog A leaves, you put out the job spec for cog B, and the comparison is literally, can they do what that person did? Which works if you are on a production line, you know, and you want to create the same thing every time. But with the rate of change that we've now got in industries across the board, what we're finding is companies are having to become more organic. They're having to be able to ebb and flow with the market demands, with what's going on in the economy, with public opinion. And that's where startups and the smaller, more agile companies have really got the edge at the moment, because they can move so much more quickly. And talking to people in large corporations, that's one of the real threats that they are very aware of. How do they get this massive machinery to be able to move as quickly as an agile startup? And we now have enough examples of the Googles and the Ubers and, you know, those kind of companies who started very small but were able to move so quickly that they literally take over the marketplace. So I think a lot of that is because the way we employ people, there's this stagnation that occurs. Because if you get the same person that you got before, you're only able to produce what you produced before. So you can't innovate as easily and as quickly. But the recruitment process used almost immediately excludes anyone who may be different. So we've got this, and this is definitely the case in the UK, probably globally, where we've fallen into the trap of, in order to get this job, you have to have done that job before. And this idea that experience is the key component. And I would argue that it's not. You know, yes, we have to have skills and qualifications, but actually you want someone who's able to innovate and think differently and push those boundaries. And that is, you just can't get that in the current standardized recruitment process. Mm. So a lot of my work is just challenging people to say, why are you using the CVs? Why are you using application forms? Nobody likes filling them out. Nobody likes reading them, because we all we all instinctively know that it doesn't tell us what we need to know about the person who we need in our organization. And from the candidate's perspective, what we see is almost a test. You know, you sit there with the CV and are they trying to trip you up? Are they reading it going, oh, what were you doing at this job? Or why is there a gap? Which obviously returning mums, there's always a gap that really stresses them out. So my focus is on just agitating that space, letting companies realize that that process isn't working for them, and then helping them just create that blank page to say, well, what would work for you? What are you looking for in your company? And I'm lucky because sometimes that's a conversation with one person who just changes how they do things a little bit differently. But I also get to talk to companies around, are you structured organizationally the right way to make the most of the people in your organization? So it's a really wide remit. Because of that, I try to focus more on just the idea that I want people to challenge where they are right now. And so a lot of my work is actually in speaking engagements and writing about it. I'm on more of a mission, I guess, than a sales pitch.
Well, I think, I mean, it's so important to have this mission because you want to encourage change in the way that companies employ others and everybody. Honestly, the number of clients that I work with, and I recently actually put out a post on LinkedIn about what is the most frustrating thing about the job search process for you. I got 7,000 hits on it. I couldn't believe it. It's like there are that many people frustrated with the process. And so I did it because I want to do some research and write a paper on the recruitment process. I reckon we should collaborate.
Definitely.
Really, really interesting. But whatever they're doing now isn't really working because there really is too high a turnover of staff in many organizations. And because everything's changing so much, you know, I did an interview last year with a speaker called Patrick Hollingworth. And what was really interesting, and I think you'd really like this, is that he was talking about too many companies. He's a mountain climber, okay? So he uses this analogy of, you know, different mountain climbing methods. Too many companies are like the expedition style mountain climbers, where you climb the mountain, but you've got lots of people with you, lots of equipment, lots of packs on your back, and it's just really big and clunky, and it takes you forever to get to the top of Everest. Whereas then there's the alpine style, where it was just this one gentleman who was just sprinting up like a mountain goat to the top of Everest. Yeah. And he took a quarter of the time of the big expedition style. And so, like what you're saying is, if you are agile, if you are more alpine style, so you can make changes and turns when, you know, there is a lot of disruption or whatever's going on in your particular industry, you'll be able to survive a lot more easily, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got this, because we have this assumption of experience being everything, what we don't realise is in order to retain people, we, you know, the six basic human needs of Maslow, right? We want certainty, but we want uncertainty. If you give somebody a job that they've done for 10 years, that's not going to necessarily fulfil their need for something a little bit different. And so we have this push and pull between wanting people to carry on doing everything, but not fully accepting that people who have been doing it for many years may get a bit bored with it and they want something different. And what we find, and particularly in financial services, in London there is such a carousel because we have people just jumping from company to company. They get a little bit more money, maybe they get slightly more responsibilities, and they jump around, and 9 times out of 10, they're back in the original company. But now that original company has to pay significantly more for them because each increment has increased their salary. So why not invest that amount in understanding what would keep them in the organization and help them train, help them develop? You know, there's been a real shift away from training people and helping them experiment with new things. In the tech space, if you are a C# developer, that's all they expect you to do. But there's other programming codes out there. There's other languages. Why don't you just retrain them? You already know they're capable of learning a coding language. So just retrain them. Keep the interest by allowing them to see that you're investing in them. But we don't. And a lot of companies really struggle with high attrition, which is caused by this lack of allowing people to explore their potential. Mm. Equally, in some companies, you have low attrition. Now, this goes under the radar of a lot of companies because they think, well, if people aren't leaving, that's fine. But why aren't people leaving? Mm. If they're not leaving, there's some inertia there that could be causing the problem. So yes, you've got people, but employee engagement is rock bottom. And you've got people who don't really want to be there, but they're just not motivated enough to move. That's as much of an issue. And so it's not a question of solving one of these little problems, these little cracks in the pipe. The whole pipe has to be looked at, because you might close one hole only for another to spring somewhere else, because we're not looking at what people want to do with their lives.
Yeah. You know what I find really, really interesting is the career anchors. So many people don't know about the career anchors. Mm-hmm. And if they know what it is that really draws them a certain direction and mm-hmm. they actually follow their anchor, they'd be so much more satisfied in their careers. And if you know what your employee or your team member's anchor really is, then you can work around it so that you can fulfill what it is that really motivates them and gets them going and wakes up in the morning. Yes? So
yeah, absolutely.
It's so interesting, and I'm sure that everything that you do when you're working with the organizations, it's a wonderful learning experience and a bit of experimentation, but you gain so many great insights into individuals.
Absolutely. Mm. Because sometimes the company, that big machinery, isn't moving because of one person. Mm. Because there's one person in that machinery who isn't ready to embrace change. They don't see the purpose behind it. They're quite comfortable. You know, some people like the fact that they're not asked to do anything different. And, you know, you've got the people who really want to be challenged. And then you've got the people who say, actually, I'm fine where I am. I've got to the level that I'm happy with. I've got the lifestyle that I like. I'm just going to stay here. And so if you're trying to move that machinery, they can be a real sticking point. So it's sometimes about identifying that person and explaining to the rest of the organization how to make that person feel better about the change, so that rather than being the block, they're actually the one that ends up really motoring through the transformation for everyone else.
Mm. You know, what's interesting too, is if you get a lot of people who've got their anchor, say, as security, then security is the be all and end all. And it's like, okay, I want to know when my paycheck's coming in. I want to know that I can pay my mortgage. I want to know what age I can retire or get tenure or whatever. There are a lot of people who are motivated by that security. So they're working, they get their paycheck, and then they live life outside of work. Whereas those who are drawn more by challenge, then obviously they want to have, you know, more problem solving and not know exactly, you know, what the problem will be the next day. And everyone's so different. But if you're drawn into an organization where everybody wants security, that really stagnates, doesn't it?
Yeah, completely.
A large, cumbersome organization where no one's going anywhere. And you're absolutely right with this. You know, if there's long tenure with everybody, you think, why are we not innovating? You won't be innovating. Everyone's doing it the way they did it back in the good old days. So, so what would you say, Lee, are your top three tips for anyone who's thinking about building a highly engaged team?
The first thing is to really think about what that team's objectives are. Now, so again, in a large organization, you have to fit into that machine. But because of that, sometimes the thing that is the least clear is what your team is actually there to do. And we talk about personal objectives, but I like bringing that out to team objectives. Right? Know what your team is in the grand scheme of things. If you can help your team members connect their daily activities to the success of the company by understanding what your team is responsible for, that can help hugely. The second tip is to embrace difference in your team, right? We tend to think, and sometimes some of the personality tests like Myers-Briggs, for example, it shows this variety of personalities, but if it's poorly implemented, it can suggest that what you need is a team of people who are all the same. And that's not true. That absolutely breaks your ability to innovate and create a dynamic in your team for high performance. So understand the individual characteristics of your team and where there is someone who approaches things differently to everybody else. Work with them to understand how they contribute, how that can help them add value, rather than seeing them as, oh, well, everybody gets it apart from that person. Sometimes it's that person who can keep your team completely on track. The last tip, I guess, is don't see people management as a side of the desk activity. A lot of team leaders and line managers are given their line management responsibilities alongside their own objectives and their own deliverables. And the issue I have with that is you're asking people to effectively do two very different things. And human nature says that they will go to the one that they are most comfortable with. As an outplacement coach with Penner, I heard a lot of people who were line managers. And when I said to them, what did you like about line managing? I got this very blank look. I was like, I didn't. I'm a techie. I'm a developer. That's the job that I'm passionate for. So all of the fact that they didn't enjoy the people management side trickled down to their team. And one person being given that responsibility who's not the right fit is absolutely a key to whether that team succeeds or fails. So I think as the line manager, know whether you are the people manager and if there's somebody else who could do it better or whether that's an area you want to explore and maybe need development in. But own it. Don't think of it as something that is a piece of your job. Because if you get that piece right, your job becomes a lot easier.
Mm. Oh, I so agree. Those are really good top three tips. And with regard to, you know, the line managers, usually you become technically very competent in something, and then you get promoted, and then you get taken away because of all the promotions from the technical side of things. If your anchor is technical functional anchor, and you're put into a general managerial type role, you'll be so miserable. And it's really important to understand what the key drivers are of individuals, isn't it?
Oh, completely. The amount of people who, and in the tech environment, they are beginning to understand that. So many companies are now creating a promotion path for subject matter experts who don't take on line manager responsibilities, but can still see progress in their career. But for too many years, the only way to progress was to take on those type of duties. In many cases, these were people who maybe joined the company as a contractor and they wanted to go perm, they wanted to convert, but the only way that they could come to an agreement about the financials was I need to have, you know, a higher grade to justify the higher wages, because coming from a contractor rate to perm tends to be quite a drop. And so part of the negotiation is, you know, I've got to come in as high as I can. And companies really had their hands tied, and they had to give these people who they wanted in the business for their technical ability, the only way they could get around the paperwork was to also give them people management responsibilities as well. And it doesn't help anybody. They're not getting the best out of the person that they have just brought in. And the team as well that they're given feel that they're not fully appreciated or understood, you know, and then there gets that resentment of, well, why did you get to lead us when 2 months ago you were the contractor sitting next to us, you know? So it's a real eye-opener for a lot of companies to understand people's drivers and go, oh, you just want to do the technology And people go, yeah, that's all I want to do. And thankfully, they're on.
Stop promoting.
Exactly, exactly. You know, I used to work with the architects of my various companies, and they were people who were very senior, but the joy came out in them when they were in a product demo or they were in the research lab. And you just thought, that's where you're thriving. And then you'd have to talk to them about you need to hire somebody, and you'd see that energy just drain away from them. And, oh, I can't be doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Usually when someone's a technical functional anchor, they don't like the people management side.
Exactly.
They don't want to worry about the personalities and when someone wants to go on holiday and you know they've got this issue with that person, because it's just not what drives them. It's so interesting. Just watching different people grow within their careers. Yeah. And, you know, when they reach that level of incompetence in a way, you know, like they're really good where they are, but just leave them alone and don't put them into this particular area. I think that we could talk all night about this, Lee.
Yes.
We're so on the same page with all of this. Fantastic. But now, if anyone wanted to get in touch with you, Lee, where would they find you?
So all of my programs and the different things that I do are available via my website at www.leelam.co.uk. That covers both my corporate work and also my personal coaching work. Rather than try to create multiple areas for people, it's all under me because I apply the same principles to everything that I do.
Oh, fantastic. And also you have your Twitter handle, which is... Hang on, let me find it. Your Twitter handle is Lee Lam Consult. And so what I'm going to do is have all of your links on the show notes on my website at janejacksoncoach.com. Great. So people can click through and find out more about what you do. And I need to tell you, because Lee didn't tell you, is that Lee hosts the LinkedIn Local London Old Street.
That's the one.
Yes. LinkedIn Local London Old Street networking events. I co-host the LinkedIn Local Sydney events with Gillian Bullock, the LinkedIn Ninja Down Under. And of course, when I was in the UK on holiday, I had to go and attend a LinkedIn Local London event, and Lee was hosting it. So if anyone's interested in networking and meeting Lee, look for LinkedIn Local London Old Street. Yes.
Yes, that's right.
How often do you have your events?
So they're once a month. Mm-hmm. They're still quite erratic in terms of timing because I utilise the offices of a company that I collaborate with called the MP Group. They've very kindly offered us out their bar area, which is it's a great space for just being able to have very informal chats. And the LinkedIn Local that I run is very informal. It is around finding the people behind the profiles rather than that sales pitch. And what I love is and Jane, I'm sure you have the same, when people come through and they're expecting to have to do their 30-second pitch and you go, no, I just want to talk to you. And that relief that comes from them, and you get some real insight. So I absolutely love it. And Old Street is the closest that I could get to the city. The next one will be in September, but the date is still to be confirmed because my contact with MP Group has gone on holiday. So missing out on this gorgeous weather.
Well, it is a school holidays in the UK, isn't it?
Exactly.
Right until the end of August.
Yes,
so
that's right.
I'm so fortunate to have been able to chat with you, especially because we were supposed to chat a month ago and I had laryngitis and no voice whatsoever. So this is like take two or two. And I'm still a little bit throaty, so forgive me. But thank you so much for your time, Lee. It was so much fun and also very interesting talking to you. And thank you for sharing all of your insights and your career journey too.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, look for Your Career Podcast on iTunes and leave a review. And for all the career management support you need to create your dream career, visit janejacksoncoach.com and join my Careers Academy for live career webinars, group coaching, one-on-one coaching support, as well as my online career development courses. Isn't it time you found your dream job?
You've been listening to Jane Jackson Careers. Sign up to receive regular career advice at janejacksoncoach.com.
If you enjoyed this episode of Your Career Podcast, I invite you to check out my career success program at thecareersacademy.online. The Career Success Program is the original program that uniquely provides 24/7 on-demand career support and fortnightly live career coaching sessions to keep you on track to reach your career goals. It is the essential resource for anyone who wants to manage their career effectively, make a career change, and land the job they'll love. Whether you're in exploration mode or seeking a new career direction and need help to make it a reality, the Career Success Program is for you. Not only do you get access to my step-by-step roadmap to navigate your career crossroads, my extensive training library and exclusive members-only discounts and tools, you'll also become part of my supportive community of professionals who will help you with feedback, encouragement, and advice. All this and more makes the Career Success Program the number one place to be for anyone looking to start, manage, and grow their career. Check it out and join me at thecareersacademy.online.